Now, a study from the Pew Research Center found that three of Wisconsin's metro areas, Wausau, Janesville, Beloit, and Sheboygan, all have some of the highest concentrations of middle-income earners in the country.
Despite those high numbers, Wisconsin's middle class has had a difficult decade and a half with real median income falling. Sheboygan saw the worst decline in median income among the 229 cities that were studied.
Joining us now to tell us more about the middle class in Wisconsin and beyond, we have Steve Deller with us. He's a professor of agricultural and applied economics at UW-Madison. Steve, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, thanks for having me. Before we get going, who do I talk to about making my pledge?
Well, probably not me, but we'll get you somebody out in the hallway after. Thank you, Steve, for that. Well, let's look at the middle class in Wisconsin. First of all, this study looked at a lot of metro areas, not all of them. They didn't have data for every area, but this stands out in Wisconsin. You've got four areas in the top 10 in the country when it comes to the percentage that falls into this middle income, this middle class group. What's the deal with that?
That doesn't really surprise me. When you look at Wisconsin's income levels, we have historically been kind of in the middle of the U.S. We're not a particularly wealthy state. We're not a particularly poor state. We're kind of right in the middle there. I think the more interesting story is what's been happening over the last 10, 14 years.
So, yeah, we see around the country, according to this study, middle class decline, fewer people in the middle class. I could think of two reasons for that. They're making more money and going into the upper class, or they're making less money going into the lower class, which tends to be the trend nationwide and here in the state.
Well, I think nationwide, it's the growth in falling into the lower income category. For Wisconsin, there were, there were six metropolitan areas that were included in the analysis. And of those six, two actually kind of saw a growth, a movement up into the upper income. That was Eau Claire, was doing very, very well. And Sheboygan actually did pretty well. The other metro areas, Janesville, Milwaukee, Racine, and Wausau, actually saw a growth in the lower tier of the income.
Before we dig deeper into the details, this fits into this national conversation about rising income inequality. What are the concerns if we see a decline in the number of people in the middle class and more people concentrated at the extremes?
I think what's happening is that when you look at the distribution of income, there's really two things that are going on. One is if you think of it as kind of a bell-shaped curve, and the tail, the high end, the one percenters, is just shooting way out there. And I think that's one of the concerns, is that the super rich are getting even super, super rich. I think that's drawing a lot of attention because it's kind of in our face. But I think the bigger concern is that the tail of the distribution that is lower income is growing. And I think what we're seeing is the growth in the number of working poor.
What's driving this at the bottom end, first of all? What's driving this growth, as you say, of the working poor, people moving down from the middle class into this lower income category?
Part of it is a shift in the economy. A lot of the job growth that is occurring right now is not in those middle income sustainable occupations or industries. A lot of the growth of the middle income in the U.S. has historically come from manufacturing. And manufacturing in the U.S. has gone through some fundamental changes. One of the biggest changes is kind of the shift away from labor to technology, robotics. Making a car today, a plant would take 6,000-7,000 employees to operate. Now that same plant is working with 500 employees. The nature of the work has been changing. We're seeing more growth in personal services, and those tend to be lower paying.
I've heard two different arguments about why this is happening on the show. One from the economist, I think it was Tyler Cowen, saying, this is natural. This is a technological change. This is a change in the way we manufacture. Get used to it. Enjoy the free downloads, basically, because you're not going to make a lot of money. The other, we had Brad DeLong and his colleague on not that long ago saying, no, this is the result of specific policy changes made starting in the Reagan era, followed up in the Clinton era to try to have an information economy, a banking economy, a service economy. Where do you fall on that?
I think it's part of, I don't think it's a policy outcome. I think it's really more of just a change in the way that the U.S. economy is structured. You have to realize that after World War II, the U.S. economy had no competition. We were it. Our manufacturing dominated because there was nothing. I mean, we bombed Europe and Japan back to the Middle Ages. So we had no competition. So we were able to generate high-paying jobs. But now, as that competition has come online, we're seeing that, we're losing that advantage, and that's being reflected in our wages.
We hear on the presidential campaign trail from Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders that we are losing on the international stage in part because of trade deals we've made. We've made, according to Donald Trump, really, really bad deals. Is there something to that, or is this just there's more competition out there than there used to be?
I think it's just more competition that's out there. I think that what we're essentially saying or seeing is that developing countries who are coming online are able to provide goods particularly and some services that are simply cheaper than what we can produce, which means that we need to adapt. We need to change.
We're talking to Steve Deller about a new study from the Pew Research Group that found that Wisconsin has the most middle-class metro areas, but wealth for middle-income earners on the decline in Wisconsin and around the nation.
You can tell us what you think. Call in. Are you a middle-income earner in Wisconsin? Were you hit by the Great Recession, and were you able to recover from it or not? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Do you work in an industry where people haven't gotten a raise in a while? What's the situation like for you? Call 800-642-1234. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with UW-Madison economist Steve Deller, talking about a new study that says while Wisconsin has the most middle-class metro areas in the country, real income is on the decline in those areas.
And we want to hear from you. Is this you? Are you in the middle class? Are you worried maybe that you won't be in the near future? Is there more than one earner in your household? And how's it going staying in the middle class maybe with two incomes? Is it working out for you? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Tell us if you've moved out of income brackets. Have you moved up or down over the last decade? Maybe in the years after the recession. You can call us right now at 800-642-1234.
Steve, I want to start off before we go to our callers. Kurt from Wausau sent us a message, a great question. Can we define what middle class means? I've been throwing around the phrase pretty loosely here. What do we mean? What does it mean in terms of the study or in general when we're talking about economics?
That's a great question. And the way that the Pew Foundation defined it is that you take median household income, national average, and you essentially say what is two-thirds of that level. Okay, that defines the lower end. And then you say now take two times median household income, and that defines the upper end. So that's how they kind of set their boundaries. Now the question is that the correct definition of middle income? Well, you get 10 people in a room, you're going to get 10 different answers.
But for that group in that range, it sounds like, at least in Wisconsin, I think I saw that group's income is going down. So somebody in the middle group now is earning less than they used to.
Yes, and that, I think that's really important. I think the more important thing that came out of this Pew study is they looked over a 10-14-year period. And when you look back in 2000, or actually it's from the census, so it's 1999 data, is the boundaries that defined middle income or that middle income range was actually higher than it is today. So what it takes to be in the middle income has actually declined over time. That's moving us in the wrong direction. So you could have been middle income 15 years ago, but that criteria has changed, and you're actually now out of it because that whole thing, the whole band is moving downward.
Let's go to our callers now. We've got Robert on the line in Green Bay. Robert, hi.
Yeah, I think I agree with him that, 2008, a lot of people were asked to do, some concessions and, help out. But then when things came back, a lot of people ended up working for, less and doing other people's jobs. But what I wanted to ask him about with the competition, though, is does he feel that there's a equal playing field? I got a friend of mine, an electrical engineer at Harley, and he claims that to get his bikes ship to India and China and some of the big markets, there's huge tariffs. And then when they bring other, and that goes for other commodities that are coming back in, you know, at our company, we bring things in from the Pacific Rim, and it's just for duty and freight. And when you go to ship things to other countries, they're more nationalistic. And I think our companies are less and less. Now, they don't, the American companies that are having things built overseas, they don't want to pay a big tariff to get it back in. They just want to lay everybody off, not pay them insurance, not buy machines.
Robert, thanks for the call. I want to get Steve in on this. So are we on an unlevel playing field, and is that hurting manufacturing in the United States in particular?
Well, there's two points that Robert raised. One was whether or not tariffs are really playing a role here. And actually, over time, those tariffs are going down. That's part of the free trade agreements, is to get that
in other countries, too.
In other countries, too. So the tariffs are kind of alleviating. Now, the second point is that if I, as a person, as an individual, want to bring a Harley-Davidson into a foreign country and register it as an individual, that's fundamentally different than if a company, say Harley-Davidson, wants to enter that market and start exporting to that market. Registration fees and things like that are fundamentally different in different countries.
Robert, thanks for that call. We'll go to Cindy next in La Crosse. Cindy, hi.
Hi. My husband and I were considered middle class before 2008. And when we had the economic downfall then, we lost a lot of our stock options and quite a bit of money. Since then, my husband works for a large company that, like I said before, sustained us quite well and didn't have a shortage of money paying our bills and maintaining a comfortable life. Now that we are struggling to keep our home, I am working in the healthcare field, and in a two-week period, I'm putting in 180 hours at a wage that's $11.60, and trying to maintain our status as middle income and keep our home.
Cindy, thanks a lot. Good luck to you, Steve. Probably a lot of people have similar stories. I want to key in on one point. They've gone from a one income to a two income family, which in this Pew study, we have a lot of that, maybe more of that in Wisconsin than elsewhere in the country.
I think that's true. I think what you're seeing is that as more jobs are at this $11, $12 an hour with limited benefits, if any benefits, as we're generating more and more of those kind of jobs, you're seeing people that are going to have to work more than one job or a dual income. I think that's just a necessity of the new U.S. economy.
All right, Cindy, thanks a lot for that call. Steve, so much more to talk about. We'll have you on again to pick up this thread sometime. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That was Steve Deller, professor of agricultural and applied economics, talking to us about a new study from the Pew Research Institute saying Wisconsin has the most middle-class metro areas in the country, but seeing a decline for middle-income earners around the state and around the nation.
Coming up after the news, amid controversial ads and accusations about who's more serious about reducing debt, the Senate race between Ron Johnson and Russ Feingold continues. We'll get the latest.
And remember, you can support important conversations like these with your pledge to WPR. Pledge right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552 on the last day of our pledge drive.
Still looking for 7 more pledges to go by the time we hit 4 o'clock. You can help us get there on the last day of the drive. Make your pledge at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferrett. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. The race toward the November election is heating up, and the matchup between incumbent Republican U.S. Senator Ron Johnson and former Senator Russ Feingold is no exception.
The pair have been in the news sparring about national debt, Washington insider status, and the scandal at the Tomah VA facility.
Eleanor Neff Powell is with us now to catch us up on this closely watched contest. She's assistant professor of political science at UW-Madison and faculty affiliate at the La Follette School of Public Affairs. Eleanor, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, one of the big stories in the race in the last week or so is the now revised ad attacking Russ Feingold on the issue of the scandal at the Tomah VA. What is the backstory there?
Well, the backstory is that several years ago at the VA, there was over-prescription of various drugs that essentially leading to various deaths of veterans. And essentially the original charge that Senator Johnson was making was that people had notified Senator Feingold and that he had failed to act. There's a little ambiguity about whether essentially Senator Feingold ever received that message or not. And so his failure to act, whether or not that was really his fault or not.
And some would say a lot of ambiguity. PolitiFact looked into this, and they rated this claim false. What did they find, you know?
Well, they essentially found that the evidence that the group had put forward that Senator Johnson or Senator Feingold failed to act was basically a little handwritten note in a margin claiming by the people who sent the memo, claiming that he had received the memo. And so there's no real evidence to know whether or not he received the memo or whether it was really sent or not. So it's really impossible to know how fair this is.
Well, this has been revised now, but here's a little taste of the original ad.
I found out that Russ Feingold got a memo in 2009 that outlined veteran harm, and nothing was done. Russ Feingold ignored veterans' concerns while veterans were dying at the facility.
Now, that ad was revised by the Freedom Partners Action Fund, funded by the Koch brothers and Wisconsin's Diane Hendricks. And how unusual is this, that an ad would get a strong pushback from its target, in this case Russ Feingold, and then the ad would actually be revised? That seems pretty unusual.
Yes, a strong pushback is certainly not unusual, but actually getting the ad revised is fairly unusual. And that was in part because several local stations pulled the ad and refused to continue airing the ad.
Yeah, so TV stations saying, no, we're not going to air the ad. Now, not all TV stations, but what do you need to do as a politician to refute a claim strongly enough that a television station would say, okay, we're not going to play this ad, and then eventually it gets revised?
Yeah, I mean, usually it's difficult to provide strong evidence to convince them to do that. In this case, there really was no evidence that Feingold ever received this information, and so it was a pretty harsh charge without too much evidence, you know, documenting it, supporting it. So in this case, you know, because no one had evidence that Feingold actually heard the or received the information, you can't really say that he failed to act based on information that he may never have received. So it's a somewhat unusual situation where they were actually able to find, you know, a sort of lack of evidence in this case.
Now, even though this ad has been revised now and it does not say that the ad was delivered, the ad in large part is still up there in the airwaves. There's online ads saying maybe the Feingold failed veterans. So has damage been done with this? Is this getting traction?
Yeah, it's a pretty harsh ad, and certainly doesn't, I think, not one that Senator Feingold would want voters to see, and may be hitting home with a lot of people. It's tough to know. We have relatively little polling in the race in terms of, you know, not very frequent polls, and so it's sort of difficult to get a gauge on what impact it's had on voters thus far.
What do we know about the most recent polling?
Well, the most recent polls show, again, depending on the pollster and the exact date of the race, essentially former Senator Feingold with a lead of between 3 and 10 points. It depends a little bit on the pollster and the exact timing of the poll.
And do we know when we'll see more numbers?
We don't. Presumably in the next several weeks we'll get more polls in, but there was a sort of flurry of polling around the Wisconsin presidential primary, and there have been sort of relatively few polls since then.
We're talking right now with Eleanor Neff Powell from UW-Madison, talking about the latest in the Senate matchup race between Russ Feingold and Ron Johnson. Now, another issue to emerge in recent days has been the issue of the national debt. And Feingold and Johnson have been sparring about who has been more serious and maybe more effective about reducing the debt. What are both sides saying?
Well, you know, this is a sort of classic back and forth, sort of each charging that the other was more responsible for increases in the national debt and sort of showing various competing numbers about debt increases during the other's time as senator and sort of arguing about sort of that person was responsible for the debt increases while they were in the Senate. And, you know, those are each somewhat unfair charges in that, you know, any one senator has pretty little impact on the sort of total nature of the debt. the sort of big increases in the debt we've seen over the last several years had to do with the financial crisis, and before that, the Bush tax cuts, and, you know, it's sort of hard, and the Iraq and Afghanistan wars, and sort of at some level sort of hard to blame former Senator Feingold for the Bush tax cuts and for the Iraq and Afghanistan war, even if he was in office, you know, at the time.
Now, with the big issues that are at play during this race, things like national security and income inequality and immigration, are people going to care about national debt at this particular moment?
It seems less likely to be one of the sort of more salient issues in the campaign, but it's sort of tends to be a classic conservative Republican campaign issue, usually more so for Republicans than for Democrats. And so, you know, I think Senator Feingold sort of trying to take on Senator Johnson on his turf.
Now, in the last week or so, Senator Ron Johnson did sit down to meet with President Obama's Supreme Court appointee Merrick Garland, nominee. What do you make of that choice to do that when there is essentially a roadblock for Merrick Garland?
Well, it's sort of strategically he's trying to thread the needle here. The Republicans in the Senate, including Senator Johnson, are on the record sort of refusing to hold hearings and refusing to move forward with the nomination. But he's sort of trying to appear less obstructionist by agreeing to meet with Judge Garland. And so it's sort of trying to have it both ways a little bit on the issue.
Do we have a sense about how Wisconsin voters feel about the nomination and what Republicans should do?
We don't have a lot of detailed polling on this issue in particular. Most of the sort of larger national polls seem to suggest that people think that the Senate should act, at least have hearings and vote on the confirmation in the near future, but it does not look like that's likely to happen.
Now, in terms of impact, how closely would you say this race is being watched nationally?
The Wisconsin Senate race is definitely being watched closely nationally. It's, you know, there's a chance that the Democrats, if everything went incredibly well for the party, could pick up the Senate in November, and Wisconsin would be a big part of that listing. Senator Johnson's one of the most vulnerable Republicans in the Senate, and it looks like it's going to be one of the most expensive Senate races in the country.
What do you expect to emerge as sort of the key sticking points of conversation as the race progresses?
Well, I think it's possible that the presidential race may have an impact and sort of how that affects turnout within the state on Election Day and sort of how popular Clinton and Trump end up being at the end of the day.
Now, in the months past, Feingold and Johnson have also been sparring about who can rightfully be charged with being out of touch with Wisconsin. Now, Russ Feingold's campaign has been saying that Johnson has been gone for chunks of time in the state, hasn't been around much. Johnson's campaign challenges that. What is your sense about how voters feel about that question, about who's the most or the least in touch with the people of Wisconsin?
Well, you know, classically, sort of being out of touch with your district and not spending time at home is sort of one of the classic campaign issues and campaign arguments that politicians make. And it can be a devastating claim if voters perceive the politician to actually be out of touch. I think both campaigns are trying to push back pretty hard and sort of argue in favor of their Wisconsin connections and their sort of understanding the people of Wisconsin. It's a little unclear how effective those charges will be against each senator in that, you know, they both spent some amount of recent time in Wisconsin.
Now, nobody knows how having Donald Trump as a presumptive nominee is going to play out, but what kinds of things are you looking at when you weigh how that could end up affecting this particular race and other races that might be similar to this one on the national scale?
Yeah, it's an incredibly big open question. This is one of those election years where predictions seem to do poorly and lots of unexpected things have happened. I think one of the biggest impacts will be how this affects voter turnout on election day. Traditionally, low turnout races tend to favor Republicans, but if Trump ends up being unpopular and sort of consistent with his current poll ratings, that could drag down Republican turnout, you know, across the country. And certainly Senator Johnson will be relying on a, you know, strong, loyal Republican base and sort of independence-leaning Republican to turn out on Election Day.
Aside from the turnout itself, is there anything about the candidacy, the issues, the personality of Donald Trump that could affect the race?
Well, he has been certainly making polarizing statements that have seem to have alienated large parts of the electorate, and his favorability ratings are among the lowest, or certainly the lowest we've seen of any major party nominee. I mean, sort of somewhat ironically, you know, former Secretary Clinton's ratings would be the lowest of any nominee, but Trump's are significantly lower than her ratings are. So it's sort of a race of unpopular candidates all across the board.
Eleanor, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Eleanor Neff Powell is Assistant Professor of Political Science at UW-Madison and faculty affiliate at the La Follette School of Public Affairs. She joined us there to talk about the latest from the Feingold-Johnson race for U.S. Senate.